Good morning, body.
Good morning.
Our reading is going to be coming from the book of Revelation, chapter 5. Then I saw in the right hand of the one seated on the throne a scroll written on the inside and on the back sealed with seven seals. And I saw a mighty angel proclaiming with a loud voice, "Who is worthy to open the scroll and break its seals?" And no one in heaven or on earth or under the earth was able to open the scroll and to look upon it. And I began to weep bitterly because no one was found worthy to open the scroll or to look into it. Then one of the elders said to me, "Do not weep. See, the lion of the tribe of Judah, the root of David, has conquered so that he can open the scroll and its seven seals." Then I saw between the throne and the four living creatures and among the elders a lamb standing as if it had been slaughtered, with seven horns and seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent out into all the earth. He went and took the scroll from the right hand of the one who was seated on the throne. When he had taken the scroll, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell before the Lamb, each holding a harp and golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayer of the saints. They sing a new song. "You are worthy to take the scroll and to break its seals, for you were slaughtered, and by your blood you ransomed for God saints from every tribe and language and people and nation. You have made them a kingdom and priests serving our God, and they will reign on earth." Then I looked and I heard a voice of many angels surrounding the throne and the living angels and the elders. They numbered myriads of myriads and thousands of thousands, singing with full voice, "Worthy is the Lamb that was slaughtered to receive power and wealth and wisdom and might and honor and glory and blessing." Then I heard every creature in heaven and on earth and under the earth and in the sea and all that is in them singing, "To the one seated on the throne and to the Lamb be blessing and honor and glory and might forever and ever." And the four living creatures said, "Amen." And the elders fell down and worshiped. May we have ears to hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Good morning, church. So this week, my father died. And I was surprised by my grief. My dad and I have been estranged for many years. We haven't spoken more than just a 5-minute conversation here or there on perfunctory days when one of us thinks we should check in and see what's going on. But every single one of those phone calls ended with significant hurt. We entered back into patterns of pain that stretched back decades between us. There were words that cannot be unsaid. There were choices that cannot be undone. And so my father and I just lived estranged. We just coexisted. So when I got the call that he had passed, I thought I would feel some relief. Some of you may remember that last year my dad had a major health crisis, and I thought, oh, this is it. This is when I say goodbye to my dad. And he pulled through. And so I thought that when I got the call that my dad was brain dead, that he had a massive stroke and basically was living, was being held together, was alive because of machines, and we were making the decision to turn them off, I thought I would feel some kind of relief, maybe even numbness, maybe even like a sense of rightness. You know, I've already grieved my dad. I've already dealt with the loss of the relationship that we should have, could have had. So yeah, this feels like the reality of what we've been living with for years. But instead, after figuring out everything between his complicated first family and the decisions that were made about what's happening next, when I flipped out of type A mode, I looked at TC and said, "I think I need to go for a drive." And I drove to the Target in Edina, and I found myself near weeping. Not just for the man who had died, but for the relationship that we never had, for the conversations that we'll never have, for the healing that won't happen on this side of heaven. So my therapist has a name for this, because of course, got to talk to my therapist, Shawnee, about this. She calls it ambiguous grief. And it's a term that was coined by Dr. Pauline Boss, who describes it as the most stressful type of loss because resolution is impossible. It's the mourning we do when our loss is complicated, when we're grieving not just what was, but what could have been, what should have been, what we always hoped might still could be possible. It's the grief that gets stuck because there are no cultural rituals or rules for supporting someone experiencing an ambiguous loss. I remember saying a year ago after my dad had the health crisis, I remember saying to somebody, well, I've already grieved the loss of the relationship that we had. And they said, well, are you gonna go if he passes? And I said, no, like the pain has been too much. The harm has been too great. Going back would just be really hard for me and my mental health. So I'm not gonna go. And that friend like just kind of stared at me like, well, what do I do with that? Like, there was a part of her that wanted to encourage me to seek good mental health, but then there was another part of her that was like, but like, isn't that what you do when your parent dies? You just go and be with your family? There's really no landmarks or no guidance, no blueprints for how we hold somebody with ambiguous grief well, which is why I've been trying to be really gentle with myself this past week. Which is why I was also like, when Pastor TC was like really sick and he gave me this passage the day after my dad died, I was like, are you serious, Holy Spirit? Like, what's the deal? This kind of grief, when there's no one, no like landmarks, like I said, no blueprint, it can be very isolating and confusing. So I've sat with my ambiguous grief in this passage all week, and I realized that this is not just my own personal story. That many of us in this room are experiencing their own version of ambiguous grief. We're kind of living in a collective moment of ambiguous grief, aren't we? As one researcher puts it, collectively, we are experiencing things from school shootings to racial injustice, and it affects us all in a collective and communal way. We are grieving together, and none of us knows how to escape the grief or the loss. We're mourning the democracy we thought we had, the safety we assumed our children would inherit, the communities we imagined we are building together. We're grieving the victims of gun violence while also mourning our sense of security. We're weeping over political divisions while also grieving the friendships that those divisions have cost us. Or a father that division has cost us. We're facing financial hardship while mourning the American dream we were promised would be ours if we just worked hard enough. Maybe you don't even know how to describe this terrible feeling in you. Maybe you're not sure that it feels stark enough to be dread, so you're like, is this dread? Am I exhausted? Am I hopeless? Am I hangry? It's ambiguous loss, my friends. It's that complicated grief because it's not just about what you've lost, but it's about what you're continuing to lose or with the fear of what you might lose. And it's something that we've never really known how to deal with. So just like my grief for my father, this collective grief doesn't fit into neat categories. And so we can sometimes be talking to somebody about this collective grief or this experience of grief, this ambiguous grief we're experiencing, and they'll look at you confused, like, I want to support you, but I don't know how to support you. So in our message today, we're going to look at our passage and think about some roadmaps for roots and how we can hold each other in our collective grief. Because many of us are left wondering, what can we do? What is next? Who is worthy, capable to make sense of all of this? Who can open the scroll of our future, if you will, and allow us to see hope again? Before we dive into our passage, I want to remind us, because we're at the beginning of this series, that Revelation is not a roadmap to of future events to decode. As Bible scholar Craig Koester reminds us in Revelation and the End of All Things, that this book, Revelation, is a pastoral letter written to encourage communities facing pressure and loss. Communities experiencing ambiguous loss. John isn't trying to predict the future. He's trying to help people see their present circumstances from God's perspective. So the vision we're about to explore isn't primarily about what happens after we die, though it may include that. It's about how God's future breaks into our present pain and offers us hope in our ambiguous loss to keep going. It's about learning to see our weeping through the lens of potential, possible, hopeful worship, and our grief through the promise of God's goodness. So let's enter in the throne room vision, not as distant observers, but as people who know what it means to weep, who need to hear that someone is worthy to open the sealed places of our lives. We're going to take a journey with John from the island of Patmos as he shows us what it looks like to move from weeping to worship, how Jesus, gentle as a lamb, but mighty as a lion, meets us in our complicated grief and invites us into a song we never knew we could sing. So first, we're going to start with chapter 5, verses 1 through 4. So the first thing that we hear, or we're going to pay attention to, is this phrase, "Then I wept and wept because no one was found who was worthy to open the scroll or look inside." So we're going to start here. John is having a vision of the throne room of God, and he sees a scroll sealed with seven seals. And this scroll represents the future, God's plan for healing for the world, for making all things new. But then the call goes out, who is worthy to break the seal and open the scroll? And the answer comes back that makes John's heart sink. No one. So John begins to weep. Right there in the throne room of the Almighty, surrounded by creatures singing, "Holy, holy, holy," John breaks down and cries. And I recognize that weeping. It's the same kind of weeping I felt this week when I realized that my father and I will never have the conversations we needed to have to be reconciled. It's the same weeping I see in our nation when we stop and ask ourselves, who is going to stop this madness? Who is worthy to stop this madness? And it seems to be that the answer is no one. So we sit in this state of collective weeping and grieving. We're asking ourselves, who's going to fix this? Who is worthy to handle this mess? But as Dr. Boss reminds us, ambiguous loss creates an effect that can include depression and anxiety, hopelessness, a confused identity, ambivalence, insecurity, and a loss of trust in the world as a fair and rational place. And this is what we are seeing John emote. This like deep sense of anxiety and hopelessness and confusion and insecurity and a loss, a deep sense of loss, because there is no one who is worthy to release God's good and beautiful plan, future of hope and restoration. There's nobody around that can do it. And what I love about this moment is that John is not rebuked for his tears. The angels don't shush him. The elders don't tell him to pull himself together. People are watching. This right here, this holy, 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 isn't the place for you to weep. Nobody tells him that. John is witnessed in John's weeping and honored and held in that sacred space of God's presence. And sometimes, friends, life hands us sealed scrolls, situations that feel impossible to open, futures that seem locked away from us. It might be like my experience, like a broken relationship that is beyond repair. It might be a diagnosis that changes everything, or a dream that died, or a no that keeps coming, or a job that keeps disappearing. It may be a sense of safety that has been shattered. What is your sealed scroll? What is that thing that you feel like nobody can fix, nobody is worthy to open up and release goodness? The beautiful thing about this story is John's weeping isn't the end, though. It's the beginning. So we move into Revelation 5:5, and one of the elders says to him, after he's wept, "Don't weep. No, there's no more weeping. Look, there is someone who can open the scrolls." The elder says, "Do not weep. See, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has triumphed. He is able to open the scroll and it's seven seals. What I think is interesting is that the lion of the tribe of Judah, this person that could open the scroll was right there, but through his suffering, through his weeping, he couldn't see it. And I think that that is important thing for us to accept, that sometimes we're in a season where it's so hard, we cannot see the good. And we need someone to come and say, look, there is good. Someone speaks into John's weeping, not harshly, not impatiently, but with a tenderness, a firmness. He says, do not weep, there is someone. And I love this word, look, because it's an invitation to lift our eyes from our tears and see something we might have missed. The elder doesn't dismiss John's pain, but gently redirects his attention. You're looking in the wrong place for your answer. The announcement is this: the lion of the tribe of Judah has triumphed. Now we hear lion and we think power, right? We think strength. We think might. We picture a king who's conquered through force, who solves problems by overpowering them. That's what we think when we hear of a triumphant lion. But that's not what we see. In fact, the elder points John to look and see, and this elder invites John to take in something completely different. So who are the elders in our life that stop us to look at what is different, to see things from a different perspective? Maybe it's someone who's walked a similar road. I actually had a friend that I spoke to that said, oh yeah, I'm totally no contact. Like, and my therapist and I were like so in sync about that. It's okay. They normalized my decision. And then my therapist was like, girl, you have anxiety. Like, it is not good. Sometimes it's somebody who can normalize what we're experiencing. Maybe it's somebody who knows enough of life to say that this weeping doesn't last forever. Yes, it's really hard right now, but you're not gonna live here forever. Maybe it's just a stranger who offers just the right word at the right moment. The voices of our elders matters, just like this voice of this elder matters, who says, look and see the lion. Look and see the power and the might. So John looks and he expects to see power and might. He expects to see the triumphant lion, but he sees something different. So we move on to Revelation 5, 6 through 7. Where he says, then I saw a lamb looking as if it had been slain, standing in the center of the throne, encircled by four living creatures and the elders. So John expects a lamb. He expects his perspective to turn into something powerful and great and all-encompassing and power over, but he sees a lamb. He sees vulnerability and gentleness. He expects to see a conqueror, but he sees someone who's been conquered, slain, but who is somehow miraculously still standing. Eugene Peterson captures this beautifully in his book, Reversed Thunder, where he says that Revelation consistently reverses our expectations. What looks like defeat becomes victory. What looks like weakness becomes strength. What appears to be an ending becomes beginning. And this is the reversed thunder of the kingdom of God. And that is how we deal with our ambiguous grief, my friends. We allow ourselves to experience the reverberation of the reverse thunder. Where we look at the things that we are suffering, and we're looking at the things that we bemoan, and we're looking at the things that we expect to turn us inside out, and we look at them wholeheartedly, and we hold them in God's presence, and then we allow God to show us how they can be turned into something good and beautiful and true. This is the heart of our faith, friends. And this beautiful surprise changes everything. That God's way is overcoming, not through power, but through love. And that God is the one who is worthy to open the scroll, to hold the future in our hands. He's the one who knows what it's like to suffer. So what does this mean for us? To know that the Lamb is the one whose scars are still visible, whose wounds haven't been erased. The Lamb doesn't overcome despite his suffering. His worthiness comes through his suffering and enters into our suffering and allows it to be transformed from inside and out. What does it mean that when we turn and look and we expect to see a lion, we see a lamb, one who gets it? Well, that means our wounds don't disqualify us from God's purposes. They become a part of our worthiness. It means that Jesus doesn't stand at a distance from our pain or shout down solutions. He enters our pain and carries our sorrows and shows us that suffering can be a birthplace of something beautiful. Here at Roots, we are trying to create more opportunities to hear our stories of the places that we are feeling like we are being overcome and we are suffering, and have spaces for elders to speak in and say, here is another perspective or another opportunity to see Jesus with you in your suffering, that you will overcome, that we will overcome. We have our monthly gatherings that give us room to be real with each other. Some of the women in our congregation have created a spreadsheet full of opportunities to connect, because sometimes healing happens over coffee and not just in a counseling session. I know that the Morissettes are opening up their home coming up soon. That is a space to share our stories and be with each other. Our Paulus group gathers around books, and they're really gathering around each other's experiences through the lens of the book, giving space to share their stories. And we're hoping for many more spaces like this, because we're learning that when we tell our stories, the messy ones, the unresolved ones, the ones that don't end neatly, we're participating in the Lamb's way of making worthiness out of wounds. So the Lamb takes the scroll with scarred hands, and our wounded healer opens the future, not through strength, but through love that has been tested by fire and found genuine. So our last passage that we're going to look at is Revelation 5, 8 through 14, and then again 7, 9 through 17. So then they sang a new song. You are worthy to take the scroll and open its seal, because you were slain, and with your blood you purchased for God's persons every tribe and language and people and nation. So the Lamb takes the scroll, and suddenly the whole universe breaks into song. It starts with the four living creatures, and then the 24 elders, then thousands upon thousands of angels join in, then every creature in heaven and earth and under earth and on the sea, everyone starts singing this new song. But what makes this song new? It's the song of the redeemed, the song of people who have moved from weeping to worship, who've discovered that the Lamb's way of love is stronger than every force that ever tries to destroy us. As Justo Gonzalez reminds us in For the Healing of the Nations, and all of these resources are on the resource list on the website. Just giving Pastor Tezias a little shout out. He works so hard on that. This is the song of a community that transcends all human divisions, every tribe and language and people and nation. So let's think about what makes this song truly new. Throughout scripture, we see songs of victory. David's song after defeating Goliath, Miriam's song after crossing the Red Sea, Deborah's song after a military triumph. But this new song is different. It's not celebrating victory through conquest or power. It's celebrating victory through sacrifice and love and solidarity. It's the first song in history that praises someone for being worthy because they were slain, not despite it. The lyrics are revolutionary. You are worthy because you were slain. In a world that celebrates the strong crushing the weak, the new song celebrates the vulnerable transforming the world through love. Roots, we are a new song. We are a song of solidarity and shared suffering and celebrating our diversity. We are a song that is rooted in the power of love and presence and not conquering and belittling. We are singing a song of beloved. What makes this song new for us is we get to sing this song as a collective with the ancestors in our faith. They sang songs of longing, of waiting, of hoping for the Messiah to come. And we sing those too, but then we also get to sing songs of fulfillment. The Lamb has come, has been slain, and is standing victorious. Our song includes verses that weren't possible before. Reconciliation across every human barrier. The promise of suffering leads to healing, and the assurance that love always wins. And look at who gets to sing it. Everyone. Not just the people who'd figured it out. Not just the ones who never wept, not just the elders or those magical, whimsical, mystical creatures. Everyone gets to sing, not just the strong ones. We all get to lend our voice to this cosmic choir. So in chapter 7, John gets another glimpse of this multitude, so many people he can't even count them, from every nation, tribe, people, and language, standing before the throne and before the Lamb. And here's what's beautiful about that. It's not just people who avoided suffering. Verse 14 tells us that these are people who came out of the great tribulation. They have washed their robes and made them white with the blood of the Lamb. They've been through valleys. They've known weeping. So then John goes on to say, never again will they hunger, never again will they thirst. The sun will not beat down on them, nor any scorching heat, for the Lamb at the center of the throne will be their shepherd. The one who is worthy will be their shepherd, will hold them. The one who stands in solidarity will be their shepherd, and he will lead them to springs of living water, and God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. I wasn't going to share the story, but I had a moment similar to this wiping away of every tear. TC and I were in Boston, and we were struggling through like a ton of things. Small kids, postpartum depression, no money because he was in seminary. I was a seminary widow, so I never saw him. All the things. And I remember going away and laying on kind of like one of these like benches over here. I was like laying on it and I was like weeping, just like crying. And I was like laying there and I was thinking, God, I just need you to wipe these tears away. Like, I'm so tired of crying these tears. I just need you to wipe these tears away. And I was like praying some version of that. And some woman came up to me and she was like, are you okay? And I was like, I'm totally fine. And she's like, you don't seem fine. I was like, I'm totally fine. And she like reached into her little like fanny pack and she pulled out like tissues and she was like, here you go. And it was almost like an answer to prayer that somebody came up and brought a tissue to wipe away the tears while I was literally weeping. That is what's going on in this moment. The Spirit of God is showing up and wiping away the tears of those who weep. So if you're weeping in this place, the Spirit desires to wipe those tears away. And I really did feel kind of like cathartic. Like after she left, I was like, okay, Spirit, okay. So here's what I want you to see in this passage. This new song isn't just about someday or somewhere else. This song starts now. When we choose to love over hate, when we practice forgiveness instead of revenge, when we work for justice with gentleness instead of violence, when we create communities where everyone belongs, we roots are singing a new song, and this is the way of the Lamb. So friends, as I close, if you're in a season of weeping right now, whether it's clear-cut grief or the messy, ambiguous kind, your tears are holy. God sees them, holds them, and is not rushing you through them. This week, as I mourned my father while wrestling with years of unresolved conflict, I've learned that grief doesn't make sense. It doesn't have to make sense for it to be valid. It really did not make sense how I can miss a man who said really hateful things to me. But I did. I had this moment where I remembered being a little girl with my dad playing chess and feeling so like, I love this guy, like he loves me. And I got to sit in that and feel like a little bit of gratitude, a moment of gratitude in the midst of all the conflict. It doesn't have to make sense. And I will go back and forth between those moments of gratitude and memories of my dad that made me feel like he loved me. And then I'll swing back to the really hateful things that my dad said to me. It doesn't have to make sense. And nobody's asking for it to make sense. And nobody asked John's weeping to make sense. I can miss him. And I can mourn the relationship that hurt me. But here is what I will remember. And this is from Viktor Frankl's wisdom about tragic optimism. He says, the search for meaning during the inevitable tragedies of our human existence, even our losses, there is still hope and meaning to be found. So we can continue to search, and there are good things to be held in the midst of our brokenheartedness, just like there are good memories to hold with my dad. I can no longer change the situation, and that's okay. That's okay. Because this is what the Lamb offers you and me. not the promise that our losses will be resolved or that we can change the situation and find some sort of different meaning in the midst of them, but that we can learn to live with the ambiguity while still experiencing love, joy, peace, and hope. Because weeping is not our final destination. There is a lamb who has triumphed, and he looks like the slain lamb. A lion that has triumphed, and he looks like the slain lamb. And he is worthy to open whatever seals you find in your life, in our communities, and in our worlds. And we don't have to figure out how to get from weeping to worship on our own. We have a community of elders that can help us move into worship. Oh my gosh, Corey, that song, that Let It Go, that song was Corey, an elder, leading us from our weeping into worship. So the Lamb knows our pain and will shepherd us through it. So whether you're weeping today or learning to worship, whether you're listening for hope or ready to sing it out loud, know this, you belong to the Lamb. We belong to the Lamb. I belong to the Lamb. And the Lamb belongs to us. And that love is writing a new song over our lives. The scroll has been opened. The future is in the hands of the one who loves us the most, and we get to sing about it together. We don't have to hold the weight of the world in our muscles, in our bones. Let go, let go, let go. Thanks be to God. Amen.